This program was first broadcast on Arrow FM, Wairarapa's only community access media station, and shared on Access Media with the support of New Zealand On Air.
All right, hello New Zealand. Welcome to another episode of Turn the Page. My name is Mark Pacey from the Wairarapa Archive. Today I've got three more stories from our past to go through with you. First up, on April 15th, 1933, Albert O'Keefe, Morva Williams, Bill Such and Eric Hill set out from Matawai Hut near Levin. Their destination was Mountain Hut, Mount Holdsworth on the Wairarapa side of the Taradua Range. They had enough provisions for 2 days, the time they expected it would take them to make the journey. Instead, it would be nearly 2 weeks before they finally got back to civilization. The trip went well until they reached Broken Axe Pinnacles, a jagged rise between the peaks South King and McGregor, both of which are over 1,500 metres high. After the party couldn't go over the pinnacles because of the weather, they started walking along them. Albert slipped and fell, taking Eric Hill with them, and they both fell 40 metres. Eric was not badly injured, but Albert received a gash to the face and was knocked unconscious. After Albert had regained consciousness and received first aid, the group had lost several hours. They had no choice but to spend the night in the bush. The party expected to spend just one night outdoors, but this changed when the snow and the strong winds forced the campers off the ridgeline and away from their planned route of travel. The party now faced the prospect of trying to make their escape below the tree line, what was then untracked and little explored territory. They spent the next few days attempting to make their way to the Waiohine River, tramping through gorges and difficult terrain. When they finally reached the river, they found it flooded by heavy rains and impossible to cross. They would not get out this way. Meanwhile, it was noted that they were overdue and a search was organised to try and find the missing trampers. Several search parties from both sides of the Taradua were sent to look for them. Even a plane was used to see if they could be spotted, but despite their best efforts, no sign of the party was found. The ordeal of the trampers was not getting easier. In addition to Albert's facial injuries, he had now developed frostbite on his feet and could take him 90 minutes each morning just to put his boots on. The group attempted to follow the Waiohine, in some cases being up to their chests in the river as it followed along, not wanting to risk the conditions of the tops on the Albert's condition. The trek along the edge of the Waiohine was proving very difficult. Over 4 days, the company had progressed just 10 kilometres. Party leader Eric Hill made the decision to head back up to the ranges and try to reach Hector Track. They made it 600 metres up the Tararua, where they camped under a fallen tree. After 6 days of rain, it was hoped that the weather would soon subside and allow easier conditions to hike out. But instead, it got worse. For 3 nights, they camped under the roots of the tree. Eric cut his sleeping bag lengthwise and used it to form a lean-to, just to provide a bit of extra protection against the elements. Another hike of 400 metres further up the Tararuas, the group camped again. In the freezing condition, they had no way of starting a fire. Everything they had was damp. The following day, they attempted to get over the top of the range and link up with Hector's track. The snow kept getting deeper until it was 2 feet thick and the party were forced to turn back. After a slow hike down, they made it to the edge of the Waiohine. They were now trapped between a flooded river and the snow-covered range. The food by this stage had almost run out. The daily rations for the group was either one spoonful of jam or dried skim milk with water. An airplane was heard overhead and the group quickly made a fire, but by the time the fire had taken, the smoke spire had risen, but the aircraft had gone. The group continued and eventually made it to Tortora Flats, where a jubilant and having reached flat ground, they followed a stream across the flats, hoping they were not far from civilizations. But their spirits plummeted when they saw the stream disappearing into another steep gorge. Pushing on, they came across a track and followed it, which took them back to the Waiohine. On the other side of the river, the Carterton Tramping Club was out for their weekly hike when they saw something they didn't expect to see. 4 trampers, worse for wear, slowly making their way along the river's edge. The Carterton group called out to them, but due to the noise from the river, the overdue hikers did not hear them. They continued to call out and eventually they were heard, and plans were arranged to get them across the river to safety. They were told to make their way to a nearby cradle. This was a wire that was suspended across the river with a metal cage underneath that allowed 2 people to sit and pull themselves across. After an incredible ordeal, the party of four arrived back to civilization. They had not had solid food for several days, and all remained of their supplies was a partial bottle of olive oil. They were taken to Carterton for some much-needed food and a change of clothes. Bill, Morva, and Eric made their way to Masterton before continuing on to Palmerston North. Albert was taken by car to Wellington, where he was told he must rest for at least 3 days. Their ordeal was finally over. The event later became known as the Such Search, even though Eric Hill was the leader of the group. This is most likely due to the media attention that Bill Such received later in life. He was suspected of being a Soviet spy and was tried in 1974 for passing on secrets to the communists. The case was dismissed due to a lack of evidence. For 15 days, the tramping party endured some incredibly difficult conditions. They had enough food for just 2 days, 3 sleeping bags for 4 people, and had to make most of the journey with an injured man. The hike was also made in some appalling weather conditions. Despite this, they defied the odds, and every member of the group made it back to safety. Well, there you go. So it ended nicely. Right, so I'll place a piece of music now. This is from a movie I've seen many, many times. Excellent movie, excellent soundtrack. This is Me from The Greatest Showman.
I am not a stranger to the dark. Hide away, they say, 'cause we don't want your broken parts. I've learned to be ashamed of all my scars. Run away, they say, no one will love you as you are. But I won't let them break me down to dust. I know that there's a place for us, for we are glorious. When the sharpest words wanna cut me down, gonna stand a flood, gonna drown them out. I am brave, I am bruised, I am who I'm meant to be. This is me. So now, 'cause here I come. And I'm marching on to the beat I drum. I'm not scared to be seen, I make no apologies. This is me.
There we go. Because if you haven't listened to the lyrics, listen to the lyrics. It's very inspiring. All right. In October of 1897, in Marsden Hospital, the staff were doing their rounds. There were several people in, for various reasons, who were staying overnight to recover. The hospital matron had decided that it would be nice to have a furry friend as company for her and some of the patients. After all, what brings a smile to a sick person more than a cute animal? The matron thought a kitten would be the ideal pet to have. This young feline soon grew bored in the matron's sitting room and started to explore. Leaving a kitten to its own devices might not have been the best idea, especially in a hospital full of sick people, but how much damage could one kitten really cause? As it turns out, quite a bit. The kitten, the paper named Puss, decided to get up to a bit of mischief and see what its claws could do. There was a table that had an enticing tablecloth hanging down from it. What a great thing to play with. Puss leapt up, extended his claws and dug them into the tablecloth. Expecting to hang there or hearing the satisfying tearing sound, Puss was to be in for quite a shock. On top of the table was a large kerosene lamp. This was in the days before electricity, and light had to come from other sources. In this case, a kerosene lamp. As Puss hung on there, attached to the tablecloth, he then started to slide down towards the floor. But there was no sound of tearing. The cloth was being pulled down, but slowly, as if something was heavy on top of the table. The kerosene lamp edged closer and closer to the edge of the table, and then was pulled off by the determined kitten. It fell, lit and full of fuel, towards the floor. Unfortunately for Puss, he was in the path of the lamp, and it fell on him, and he used up all 9 of his lives in one moment. The lamp broke and spilled its fuel all over the floor. It snaked its way across the room and then ignited. Hearing the commotion, the matron and the staff ran into the room. They were confronted with a broken lamp, a dead kitten, and a room on fire. The floor, the walls, the furniture were all burning now, and it was the quick action of the staff that ensured that the fire was extinguished and the damage reserved to just one room. The next day, the damage was assessed. Puss's antics had caused £50 worth of damage. Now, how much is £50 in today's money? Well, it's quite a bit. Let's not beat about the bush. It's a lot. Puss caused the equivalent of $12,550 of damage to the Marsden Hospital. The hospital was insured, and the damage was repaired. It was unbelievable that one small kitten had caused all this damage and cost. Maybe the matron should have bought a puppy. Right, next piece of music. This is from another movie. Another great movie I've seen many, many times. This, I've played this before, I don't know, a long time, a couple of years ago. I've been doing this show for a while. So you may remember it, you may not. If you haven't seen this movie, definitely check it out. This is Old Black Magic from The Green Book.
Has me in its spell. That old black magic that to you weaves so well. Those icy fingers up and down my spine. The same old witchcraft when your eyes meet mine. I love them so, yeah. That same old tingle that I feel inside. And then that elevator starts its ride. And darling, down and down I go. Round I go, like a leaf that's caught in a tide. Yeah, I should stay away, but what can I do? I hear your name, and I'm aflame. Oh, aflame with such a burning desire. Hey, that only your kiss, kiss can put out the fire. Well, now you're the lover I have waited for. You're the maid that fate had me created for. And every time your lips meet mine, yow, down and down I go. Round and round I go. In a spin, kind of loving that spin that I'm in. Under that old black magic on love. Yeah, under that old black magic on love. talking about the black old magic. Yeah, baby, because I love, oh yeah, love that thing.
And there we go. It's from the Green Book soundtrack. It's good. Excellent, excellent movie. Check it out. Right, we're to our last one. I save this one till last because I'm probably going to do some commentary at the end of it. I'm not going to do it partway through. We'll go through it and then we'll talk about it. So this is an article I wrote about a year ago about the Featherston Prisoner of War camp. And this is, I've done it with the World War One camp. You know, what was it like for someone who was in there from the time they wake up till the time they go to bed? What was the average day like? So this is what I wrote with what I understood at the time. Obviously, since then, I've been doing a lot more research, loads of writing. I've got a better understanding now. So we'll read it as I wrote it, and then I'll tear my own story to pieces at the end of it. For a prisoner in the Prisoner of War camp in Featherston, there was a routine that they were expected to adhere to. After the culture shock of the Japanese and the New Zealanders meeting and working out how we each behaved, there was a settling down of tensions and misunderstandings. Half the prisoners in Featherston were not Japanese. These were the labour force that were first captured at Guadalcanal. These men were not soldiers and didn't cause any problems and adapted well to army life, camp life. The Japanese were quite different. These were proud warriors that had now faced the shame of being captured rather than dying in combat. To be sent to a foreign country to spend the remainder of the war behind barbed wire was deeply shameful, but after a period too, they adapted to camp life. The day began with the rousing of the men. They were then able to wash and shave and be presented with their breakfast. This would, for the regular soldier, be rice, bread, butter and a hot drink of tea with sugar and milk. Life in prison can be exceedingly boring, but there were activities that were available to the Japanese that could occupy that time and earn them some spending money. There was the woodworking factory on site where prisoners made furniture. The offcuts from these they saved and turned into camp art, but also helped them occupy their time. If woodwork wasn't their thing, they could work in the concrete manufacturing area where curb stones and fireplaces were made on site. After a morning of work, they would have developed an appetite and lunch was served. This would consist of more rice, bread, butter, fruit, boiled potatoes with meat and onions, and another hot drink of tea with sugar and milk. For the afternoon, they could do more work, and some of the prisoners were allowed out of the camp and into the market gardens in Greytown. Loaded onto trucks with armed guards escorting them, the convoy of prison labour made its way to the gardens, where the public were able to watch these men as they drove past. After working in the fields, they were trucked home again. For those not engaged in work, there were other activities they could do. The prisoners had built shrines around the camp, Shinto for the familiar and Christian altars for those that had converted. They could also play games, with a baseball-style game being a popular one. Bats and balls and other sporting equipment was provided to them. Art played a big part in leisure activities. Not only did they make remarkable wooden pieces, but they were also able to do pencil drawings and watercolours. There were some talented artists in the camp, and it emphasises what a waste of life war is. These men could have been making art that would be appreciated by many, but instead they were sent to a remote part of the world to kill other men. As dusk approached, it was time to start settling down. Dinner was a hearty meal. Rice again was served with steak, pickles, and another cup of tea. Nights could consist of board games, with camp-made mahjong sets being plentiful. Reading material was also available, with the Bible being presented to anyone that wanted it. Lights out was then called, and the prisoners settled down into their huts, which they kept immaculate, to wait what the next day would bring. So I'm not going to spend a long time discussing what I've written here and giving you more detail, because I could be here for the next 1 to 2 hours just going over all the nitty-gritty. I'm not doing that. I have to get back to work. We'll just go over a couple. The first one, which this is common knowledge, this is what I believed for a very long time, I think everyone else believed, was the fact that half of the prisoners there were not Japanese. It was believed that they were Korean labourers that were captured on Guadalcanal. That's partially true. Yes, there were Korean labourers captured on Guadalcanal, but a lot of the labourers that were there also were actually Japanese. They were older ones or ones who couldn't get into the army, ones who failed their medicals. They were still expected to do their part during the war. So a bunch of them, especially ones that had engineering skills, architectural skills, they were sent there to help build the airfields and everything. So that bit's not quite true. The rest of it's not bad. I don't go into huge detail. And I also don't want to give too much away because I'm currently writing all of this and I want you to buy my book when it comes out. So a lot of things about the sort of work they did and where they did it. There's a whole chapter on that. The art that they did, there's a whole chapter on that. The leisure activities, what they did for fun and games. Again, there's another whole chapter on that as well. So the rest of it's pretty good. It doesn't actually say the time that they went to bed. It was about 9:30, lights was out, which is, seems pretty early. But when you consider that every single morning they were up at about 6:30, regardless of whether it was a Sunday, regardless of whether it was a local holiday, every day you were up at that time. They would parade and do roll call. Each compound had a leader, you know, a Japanese leader who was in charge, who basically had to rouse everyone and get them into the area where they were supposed to be so their numbers could be counted. So, yes, like I said, I'll be going into an extraordinarily large amount of detail, more than what's in here, when I finally get my book done. I'm to chapter 8, though. It's not bad. So if you want to know more there, that'll be available. So that's a bit of extra detail. So, but, again, that's what I believed when I wrote that about a year ago, and having researched it, it's changed a little bit now. So it's great to get the actual, all the details, all the stories, get it all out there. So like I said, one more piece of music. This is from one of my favorite movies. Is it my favorite movie overall? I don't know. It's definitely top five. So this is the main theme. I don't think there ever actually was a proper soundtrack. They released a couple of tracks with a bunch of others from a few other movies. But this one is fantastic. It appears throughout the film. This is Keating's Triumph, which is the main theme from the Dead Poets Society. Thank you. There we go. This is one of my favorite movies. I have two ways that I do writing. I either have my headphones on and I listen to all the other music I generally play. This is my third track, all the Hans Zimmers and things. Or I can have one of three movies playing in the background just over and over. Dead Poets Society, Whale Rider, and a brilliant horror called Sinister. So that is us done for the week. I believe Matariki is Friday, so it won't affect Monday's show. So we will see you in a week's time. I was looking at my phone the other day, yesterday, at the weather forecast, and it's saying it's going to rain all week. So something to look forward to. So yes, if you're heading out, yeah, maybe take a brolly or a raincoat, because apparently it's going to be here with us for a while. So look after yourselves. Stay dry, stay warm. We'll catch up to you in a week's time. We'll see you then. Catch you later.